The Life and Legacy of Barbara Bush. When USA Today's Washington Bureau Chief, Susan Page, set out to write a biography of Barbara Bush, she didn't know what kind of access she would have. It ended up that, in addition to the 100 interviews with friends and family members, Barbara Bush sat down for 5 interviews and gave Page permission to read her diary entries from her entire life. The result is an intimate and surprising portrait of a complicated and influential woman. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Susan Page's biography, The Matriarch, Barbara Bush and the Making of an American Dynasty, is out today, and Susan Page joins us to discuss it. We'll learn why Page considers Barbara Bush one of the most consequential first ladies in American history. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Barbara Bush was one of the most influential and underappreciated first ladies in our nation's history. That is the verdict of Susan Page, author of the just-released book, The Matriarch, Barbara Bush and the Making of an American Dynasty. Susan Page is our guest today, and in a moment, we will hear from her what surprised her about the former First Lady. Susan Page is a Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. She joins us from New York City. Susan, thanks for joining us.
Jennifer, it's such a pleasure to be on your show and on Maine Calling because, as you know, Barbara Bush did love Maine.
Oh, well, we're thrilled to have you and congratulations. And as always, we want to hear from you in the audience. Did you ever run into Mrs. Bush here in Maine? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Susan Page, you have reported on many important people. This is your first book. Why Barbara Bush for your first book?
You know, I've covered 10 presidential elections, covered 6 presidencies, and when I talked to voters, they felt they knew Barbara Bush. I think she was one of the people they felt they knew best among all the figures in public life, but I thought they didn't really get her. I don't think they gave her all the credit she was due. People would come up to me, especially during the time she was First Lady, and talk about how warm she was and what a wonderful grandmother she was and how she wore pearls and she didn't dye her hair and how authentic she was. All 100% true, but not the full story when it came to Barbara Bush. And I wanted to tell the full story.
So even then you knew that wasn't the full story.
That's right. I knew that there was more to her, that she was more complicated than people thought. I knew that she was more consequential than people thought, that she had more influence behind the scenes, in part because she didn't want her influence to be seen. But I did not really understand the ways in which she influenced her husband's presidency, her son's presidency, and more broadly, some cultural questions with America. I think that she is really one of those figures who had enormous power and influence, often in ways we didn't recognize.
In addition to interviewing 100 family members, friends, and aides, you interviewed her 5 times and had access to her personal diaries. How did that come about?
You know, you tell me, because no one was more surprised than I was. The first time I interviewed Barbara Bush, which was in October of 2017, she said, "Do not even ask me about my diaries. You will never see my diaries." And I assumed that was true, frankly. It would be such a big thing to give me access to her diaries. But the last time I interviewed her in February of 2018, and just I did not realize this was going to be the last time I would have to interview her. Perhaps she knew more than I did. The last time I interviewed her, at the end of the interview, she said, "I've thought about it and you can see my diaries." And Jennifer, I had the worst possible reporter's reaction because I said, "Are you sure?" As though maybe you want to think twice about taking this big step. But she said she was sure. And it was such a gift as a biographer to be able to see her contemporaneous thoughts and observations about what was going on in her life.
Did she write in her diary every day, every week? How often? How many were you reading?
So it varied. She started keeping these records in 1948, and sometimes she kept like a diary, like here's what happened to me today. Sometimes, when, especially when they were in China, she would write a long letter to a few personal friends, make copies of it, and have that be, in effect, her diary of that time. There were some periods of time when there were no diaries, and I don't know if she wasn't keeping them or perhaps she destroyed them. There were periods of time in her life when she did not keep diaries. For instance, during the illness of her daughter, Robin, in 1953, there aren't diaries in there, and I bet she was just overwhelmed with other responsibilities at that time. But there were times, especially when she was second lady and when she was first lady, that she would be pretty disciplined about recording what was going on in her life every day or at least once a week. And sometimes she would catch up, like she would say, I haven't written anything in a week, and let me catch up on what I've been doing in the past week. Sometimes she would write them out in hand. She would type them up. She would use her computer to keep a record in more recent years. There were times when she was second lady and first lady that she would record them and an aide would transcribe them.
I found some of the diary entries just so revealing, and I'm wondering if there are some in particular that surprised you the most or you found really were a bit of a window to her soul in a way that others that surprised you.
You know, one of the things that was most amazing about the diaries were her thoughts on Nancy Reagan. Because, you know, generally, Barbara Bush was pretty, you could pretty much tell where she stood on things in public. There wasn't like a private Barbara Bush and a public Barbara Bush. But with Nancy Reagan, she spent more than a decade biting her tongue at various things that Nancy Reagan did that just drove her crazy. The things that Nancy Reagan would say and the demands that she would make. And I think that this was a case where Barbara Bush used her diaries as a place to vent. She couldn't vent in public, so she vented to her diaries. There was one amazing chapter in her, there was a segment in her diaries where she was writing her memoir. So her memoir came out in 1994. Nancy Reagan was very concerned that Barbara Bush was going to unload on her in Barbara Bush's memoir. And she was afraid to call and ask Barbara Bush directly. They had already had a angry final phone conversation the last time they talked at length. So she had Marlon Fitzwater, who had been press secretary to both President Reagan and President Bush, call Jean Becker, who was working with Barbara Bush on her memoir, to say, what is Barbara going to say about me in her memoir? So Jean Becker went to Barbara Bush and said, Marlon called because Nancy Reagan's worried about what you're going to say in your memoir. And in her diary, Barbara Bush then wrote a joke chapter in her memoir that unveiled every single injustice and indignity and grievance she had against Nancy Reagan. And at the end of it, she said, Jean, I'm just kidding. Because she did not, in fact, say anything negative, directly negative, about Nancy Reagan in her memoir. There were a few things that if you could read between the lines, you could see there was some friction. In fact, she didn't attack Nancy Reagan in her memoir, but she didn't mind experimenting with what she might say if she was going to do that.
Oh, so maybe Jean saw this and just for fun.
I think she wanted Jean to start reading it and get more and more concerned about what was going on. And then at the end, basically say, April Fools, I'm not going to really write this.
And throughout this book, you talk about her sense of humor. I was really struck by what she said in the hospital when she was near death and her son, the president, George W. Bush, was in the room. What she said to the doctor.
She said, what'd you say, that I smoked when I was pregnant
yeah,
with him?
Yeah, she
and
said,
explained.
So you want,
or I drank,
doctor,
I drank.
Yeah, yeah. You want to know why he turned out the way he did? I smoked and drank when I was pregnant. You know, it sounds
you
like.
You know, she said.
Go ahead.
She was so quick with a quip. And I tell you, at the end of the first interview I did with her, you know, I had a title that I ended up using, but I had a title in mind, The Matriarch, Barbara Bush and the Making of an American Dynasty. Well, she didn't like the word matriarch, and she definitely didn't like the word dynasty. And I said, well, what would you title this book, this biography of you? And she said, without missing a beat, The Fat Lady Sings Again.
And that makes me sad, though, and especially after reading your book, Susan, you say you talk about her lifelong insecurities, especially about her size, perhaps rooted in her relationship with her mother. But For one, it makes me sad because I don't think other people saw her that way at all. And two, she wasn't presenting herself to the world as somebody who is vulnerable.
You know, it's so interesting. I mean, what we don't know about the people who are in public life, like Barbara Bush, or the people who sit next to us in the workplace, you know, you don't know what wounds they are carrying around from previous experiences in their life. And Barbara Bush made, her signature was to make fun of herself. She made fun of her white hair. She said she wore pearls to hide the wrinkles on her neck. She joked about needing to lose weight. But in fact, I think that veiled a real scar. Her mother was critical of her when she was a girl for her weight. Her older sister, Martha, was slender and pretty. She was a model. In fact, she appeared on the cover of Vogue, the college issue of Vogue, when Martha was in college. And I think that Barbara felt for her entire life insecure about how she looked.
Hmm. She faced great heartbreak and challenges, the death of a daughter, a miscarriage, a struggle with depression. Can you talk about how these experiences formed Barbara Bush's outlook and approach to others?
You know, it's interesting. The first draft I wrote of this book, I had the first chapter be the 1988 campaign, the campaign that elected George Bush, put him in the White House after really decades of ambition to get there. And I had the chapter talking about Robin's illness and her death, where it appeared chronologically. And when I finished this first draft, it just was apparent I had it all backwards, that the 1988 campaign was the defining event perhaps for George H.W. Bush, but the defining event for Barbara Bush was the death of Robin. And, you know, she was just 28. Barbara Bush was just 28 years old when her daughter was diagnosed with leukemia, a disease she had never heard of before. She died 6 months later after a desperate struggle, treatment at Sloan Kettering. It made Barbara Bush both harder and softer. It gave her an armor because the worst thing that could happen to her had happened to her, so she could survive anything. But it also made her more vulnerable. It made her more empathetic. And it was clear that when she was thinking about abortion rights or about AIDS or about what's important in life, she had Robin in mind. This came up when Robin was being treated at Sloan Kettering, and it was clear that she was not going to get better. No one at that point had ever been cured of leukemia. They brought Robin back to Midland, Texas for one last time so she could see her two brothers and see their friends and their neighbors one final time before going back to Sloan Kettering and passing away. And some of Barbara Bush's best friends wouldn't come to visit because they thought that leukemia was catching. And that stigma stung her. It wounded her. When she told me about it all those decades later, she was still hurt about it. And years later, when she was dealing with the explosion of HIV/AIDS in this country, and she saw the stigma around people who had AIDS, people didn't want to work next to somebody who had AIDS, babies were being abandoned by their parents if they had AIDS, she saw the same stigma, and she decided to do something about it. And she did. And in her first 100 days as First Lady, she visited a home for babies who had AIDS and made a point of picking up a baby and hugging him and having photographers take the picture to send that message.
Mm. You know, you talk about AIDS. You just mentioned briefly, Susan, abortion rights. I think a lot of people suspected that Barbara Bush was pro-choice. But you talk really in depth about how she came to feel this way and how strongly she felt that way.
You know, going through these diaries, which was such a privilege, I was going through the diaries from 1980 when George Bush was starting his first campaign for the presidency. And she knew she was going to be asked about abortion, and she wanted to figure out what she thought. And as I opened the diaries, I found four sheets of paper written out in her hand, folded over, yellowed, tucked inside the pages of the diary. And I pulled them out and I unfolded them, and the top of it said, "Thoughts about abortion." And what followed was a four-page letter to herself as she sorted out in her own mind what she thought about abortion. And she thought about abortion in the context of Robin. She said, "The moment Robin was born, I felt her soul enter her body. And the moment Robin died, I felt her soul leave her body. And therefore, abortion isn't murder, because the soul does not enter the body until you're born." Now, you can agree with her on that or disagree with her on that, but you cannot question how sincerely she tried to sort out this difficult issue in her own mind.
Hmm. There are a lot of things, Susan, in this book that are making headlines already. What Barbara Bush said about President Trump, as you alluded to earlier, her relationship with Nancy Reagan, and then also some new perspective on the rumors that George H.W. Bush may have had an affair. You don't really come to a conclusion about that, do you?
You know, it's one of the things that's been the subject of a lot of debate, and it was something that caused Barbara Bush enormous pain, the rumors of an infidelity. And so I deal with it in the book. I felt it was important to deal with it. I thought it was a part of her life. I think people have to look at what we found, what I found, and make their own decision, make their own determination of what they believe. It's certainly true that President Bush, Barbara Bush, and Jennifer Fitzgerald, who was the aide around whom all these rumors circulated, they all consistently denied there was any affair. They did that over and over again, especially President Bush and Barbara Bush. Jennifer Fitzgerald asked about it just a few times. So you have that. They're saying, no, this didn't happen. Barbara Bush called it a smear. On the other hand, if you look at George Bush's behavior, it fueled questions about the nature of their relationship, because he hired Jennifer Fitzgerald when he went to China as an aide. She was an aide close by his side until he became president, even though her presence became very controversial. It prompted other staffers to leave his staff because they didn't want to deal with Jennifer Fitzgerald. And it became the subject of public speculation. And even then, he would not get rid of her, wouldn't fire her, wouldn't have her move to a job with somebody else. And I think that's what kept the rumors alive.
We're speaking with Susan Page. She is the author of the new biography out just today, The Matriarch, Barbara Bush and the Making of an American Dynasty. Do you have a question for Susan Page about Barbara Bush? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the law offices of Joe Bornstein, a statewide practice representing injured and disabled Mainers since 1974. JoeBornstein.com. And Northeast Imports in South Portland, specializing in the sale and service of pre-owned Subarus. NortheastImportsLLC.com.
On the next Fresh Air, the deepening crisis in Venezuela, where desperate shortages of food, electrical power, and medicine have compelled an estimated 3 million people to leave the country, many on foot. We'll speak with the New York Times' Nick Casey about the political standoff in the country, the U.S. role in the conflict, and the prospects for change. Join us.
Coming up tonight at 7 o'clock, here on Maine Public Radio. You're invited to join Maine Public at the 9th Annual Thresholds Conference. Sponsored by Hospice of Southern Maine, the conference is a series of conversations about care, caregiving, and relationships at the end of life. The event takes place on May 9th at Hannaford Hall on USM's Portland campus and will feature a talk and a book signing by Weekend Edition Saturday host Scott Simon. Details are at mainepublic.org. Click on Events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, The Legacy of Barbara Bush. Joining me, Susan Page, the author of the new book, The Matriarch, Barbara Bush and the Making of an American Dynasty. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. Susan, we talked about how you had five personal one-on-one interviews with Barbara Bush towards the end of her life. And in one of those final interviews, she talked about Maine, didn't she?
Oh, she did. She loved Maine. And she was, you know, her health through these five interviews, each time I went back once a month, her health would be worse. She was clearly failing. She was 92 years old. She was suffering from congestive heart failure. But in the January interview, the interview I did in January, she was really optimistic. She had started on a new drug regimen that she thought would help her. And she said, all I want to do is go back to the beach, that is the beach in Maine, and walk along the beach and push, she was walking with a walker at that point, push my cart along the beach one more time. And sadly, that was not to happen. She would die in April before the Bushes could go back to Maine for one last summer. Although, of course, George H.W. Bush did make it back for that one last summer.
Mm. She also revealed to you that she didn't consider herself a Republican anymore.
You know, here's a woman who was the face of the Republican Party for decades, the wife of one president who was a Republican, the mother of another president who was a Republican. So imagine my shock when she said that. Now, I'd asked her that the previous fall, and after, as we were approaching the first anniversary of Donald Trump's election, I said, was opposed. I said, do you still consider yourself a Republican? She said, yes. I asked her again in February, a few months later, and she said, no, I don't think so. And that is really, I thought, a jaw-dropping statement by someone who had done so much for the GOP and over so many years.
Was it just because she was opposed to President Trump, or were there other things going on in the party that she just completely couldn't associate herself with anymore?
I think it was largely because of President Trump. You know, for one thing, President Trump had said all those mean things about Jeb Bush during the Republican primaries in 2016. She was Jeb Bush's mother. She took offense at those. She was 90 years old. She still made a trip in a snowstorm to New Hampshire to campaign for Jeb. That's how strongly she felt about it. So that was part of it. But I think she was also concerned about President Trump's tone, his attitude toward people. She was offended by some of his comments about women. And I think that this was largely driven by her feelings about President Trump. And in fact, a friend in Kennebunkport, knowing what she thought about President Trump, gave her a Trump countdown clock, which is, you know, one of those little digital clocks you can get off the internet that counts the number of days and hours and minutes and seconds until the president's term is up. These aren't unique to President Trump. I saw them for President Clinton. I saw them for President Obama. But a Trump countdown clock. And she put it by her bedside table in Kennebunkport, because she really liked this little joke gift. And then when they went back to Houston at the end of the summer, she took it with them. And she put it on her bedside table in Houston. And it was there until the day died.
Mm. Right in the beginning of the book, you write, in my view, she stands as the most underestimated first lady of modern times. Why do you think she was so underestimated? Was it her own fault?
I think not fault, but her own doing. That she did not seek the limelight except when she thought it would be helpful for her husband. You know, she was a woman of another generation. She was born in 1925. That's just 5 years after women got the right to vote. She went to college and dropped out at a time that a high aspiration for women in college was to marry a great man and then help him in his career, which is what she set out to do. She saw herself as supporting him, not as being an independent figure herself. Now, that evolved over time. You think about by the time that she was, in fact, pretty strong-minded voice during her husband's presidency. She was a pretty critical voice in George W. Bush's ear when he was president. And she was very proud of her granddaughters for the independent things they did. But she was definitely a woman of that earlier generation. And I think that's one reason that she was comfortable being behind the scenes, that George H.W. Bush was comfortable with that arrangement, and that I feel as though she never got her due for the number of consequential things that she did, for the impact she had on not only things like literacy, which she worked on so hard, but on attitudes toward people with AIDS. And I'll tell you, one of the big surprises in researching this book was the role she played in the superpower negotiations to end the Cold War, where she set out to make a friend of Raisa Gorbachev, and she did.
Mm. Susan, talk about her political savvy. I mean, I'm going to back up a little bit and say one of the details of this book that I so enjoyed was how needlepointing came up again and again. There'd be a very important moment, and Barbara Bush would have her needlepoint with her. That's almost a literary detail. But can you tell me what some of the things she was doing while she was trying to play herself down and trying to be needlepointing in the next room, what she was really doing behind the scenes, what she was doing for her husband, who was vice president and president?
So who could be less threatening than the wife who's sitting in a corner needlepointing while all the important men talked about the affairs of the day, right? But she was there and she was listening. And early on in his career, she would be an advisor behind the scenes after everyone had left. And that was something that continued even when George H.W. Bush was president, that she usually wouldn't speak up in a meeting, would wait to talk to him behind the scenes. But she was listening and thinking. And there were points, critical points, during political campaigns where her voice really mattered. And, you know, there were, during the 1988 campaign, the successful campaign that he had, there were two points where it was her voice saying that it was all right to run some critical ads, some very tough negative ads that convinced George Bush to run them. And if George Bush had not done that, there are political analysts who say he would not have won the Republican nomination, that it made, at least arguably, made the difference in winning the Republican nomination. And he ran those ads only after getting the endorsement of Barbara Bush.
Another detail I like is your picture of what life was like in Kennebunkport when she would be going back and forth with a foreign dignitary who may be visiting the president and talking about a really important matter of international importance, and at the same time corralling grandkids in the same house at the same time. It's almost mind-blowing to imagine that.
It sounds like a sitcom, right? You could
yes.
do a Big Brother, House of Big Brother there with all that was going on in Kennebunkport. I would love to hear from some of your listeners about their own experiences, because one reason they loved Maine was because they could be more regular folks in Maine than they could at the White House in Washington. They could go to Mabel's and have a lobster sandwich, the wrong nomenclature. They could have a lobster roll at Mabel's. They could go down to the grocery store. That's one reason that they loved being up there. And I bet there are listeners of yours who either knew them or who would see them around town or at a restaurant. And I would love to hear about their experiences.
Well, we will. We'll go to Lynn in Sanford. Hi, Lynn. Go ahead.
Yes. I have an untold story that's probably not mentioned, but my landlord told me this. He and his brother were out on a tuna boat in Kennebunk. So they decided to try to go to Kennebunkport and stop in at the Bushes while they were having a barbecue.
Did it work?
No. They got stopped by security.
Well, Lynn,
but you know...
Funny. Go ahead,
Susan.
You
know, Lynn, I bet if Barbara Bush, or especially George Bush, had seen them, he would have told them to come on up.
I bet he would, too. Oh, and my favorite president is Barbara Bush.
Lynn, thank you.
You know, my
go ahead.
Lynn, thanks so much. That reminds me, I've been working on this book for a while, and in fact, my poor family had to endure a year when, no matter what the topic was, I told a Barbara Bush story. They've been giving me Barbara Bush memorabilia, and they gave me one of my sons gave me a political button that from the 1992 campaign that says, Barbara Bush's husband for president.
Lynn, thanks for calling, and we welcome anybody else who would like to call and share your story about Barbara Bush. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Susan, I was chatting about this book with our political reporter, Mal Leary, yesterday. And Mal remembers covering George Bush when he was vice president at Walker's Point, and Barbara Bush coming out with a plate of chocolate chip cookies for the press. She had a way of engaging the press that, frankly, I have not ever experienced. And I'd love if you could tell the story from Houston when the press was waiting on the presidential announcement.
So this was they were waiting. There was a press group outside their house in Houston at the point that when the question was whether George Bush was going to drop out. This was in 1980. He'd done well early. He had won the Iowa caucuses, but he lost the New Hampshire primary. It was clear that Ronald Reagan was going to be the nominee, but George Bush was not himself like quite mentally ready to hang it up. And so there was a meeting with all of his top advisors in Houston, and there was a press group that was, you know, doing what we do, right, which is hang outside of places endlessly waiting for people to come out and tell us what's going on inside. And it was really hot. You know, Houston, it can be a pretty hot place. And they met for one day, and they decided they would meet again the next morning. And as they're leaving, Pete Thiele, who was George Bush's press secretary at the time, said to Barbara Bush, okay, we're going to leave. We're going to come back tomorrow morning. Whatever you do, don't talk to the reporters outside. Don't engage with the reporters. If you don't do anything else, just don't do that. So the next morning he comes back to the house, and all the press equipment, the cameras and stuff are on the front porch, and there are no reporters there. And he goes around to the back where they had a pool, and the reporters are drinking lemonade that Barbara Bush was serving them, and they were sitting around the pool, and he said to her, I told you don't talk to them. And she said, well, it was very hot.
I love that story. I never had anybody invite me to their swimming pool in all the years I did Daily News Reporter Susan. What about you? Did that ever happen to you?
Well, you know, I'll tell you what the Bushes did do. You know, I spent during his presidency, every summer I would come up to Kennebunkport for coverage duty. I was covering the White House then for Newsday, the newspaper in New York. I do have to say this was not the toughest assignment I ever got as a reporter, to come up to Kennebunkport in August. And at the end of these summers, the Bushes would very generously hold a picnic for the journalists who were up there covering them, which was so nice of them. And I go to this picnic with my husband, who's also a journalist, and with our two little boys. And we're at this picnic, and my two little boys, as they often did, were misbehaving, so I'm frantically trying to corral them to keep them from doing any damage to the president's summer home. And Barbara Bush comes up to me with Millie, her dog, and said, how can you work when your children are so young? And initially, the very first thing I thought was, oh, she's teasing me. And I said something flip back, and it became very clear she was not teasing me. She was scolding me for working when my kids were young, because that was not what she had done. It was not what she thought was right. She said to me, my daughters-in-law who have young children are not working. And, you know, at the time I took some offense at this, I have to say, because I didn't think it was her decision. I thought it was mine. I felt that I couldn't respond with what I was thinking because she was the first lady and I was a reporter. And I was I was at her picnic, so I tried to basically back away. But now, with the benefit of some hindsight, I see that this, with Barbara Bush, you knew where you stood. And she didn't think it was right to work when your kids were younger. At least she thought you ought to think about it hard before you did it. And so with retrospect, I have more respect for that exchange than I did at the moment it happened.
And you believe that she came to feel differently because she's awfully proud of her granddaughters, correct?
She was very proud of her granddaughters. And she was, she totally accepted the idea that they were going to work when their kids were young. Jenna Bush Hager told me that when the Today Show offered her a bigger role on the Today Show that would mean more time on the air, but also more time away from her children, who were very young and are still very young, that her grandmother encouraged her to do it. So clearly her views on that evolved, as did her views on any number of other things.
I'm going to go to another caller. This is Patty in Harpswell. Hi, Patty. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for this wonderful interview. I can't wait.
Patty, we can barely hear you. Can you get a little closer to the phone?
Oh, I'm sorry.
There you go. Much better.
Thank you. Great interview. We were in County Bancourt to have dinner, getting ready for our daughter's rehearsal dinner. So we were trying different restaurants. And we drove from Harpswell, and we arrived at the restaurant. There were seven of us. And the hostess said, oh, we have special guests coming this evening. And my husband said, oh, really? And so she said, yes, the Bushes will be joining us. And that is until 8. And so we sat down, and we were having our dinner. And maybe there were two other tables with guests. And my husband said, oh, the Secret Service are here, because they were walking around. And in they came, and Mrs. Bush walked straight up to our table, and she said, hello, I'm Barbara Bush. Who are you? And we said who we were. And she said, fabulous restaurant. We dine here all the time. It's perfectly wonderful. It's a pleasure to meet you. And then came the president, and the rest of the twins were there, and Jim Nance was there. And she stood at the table, and she said, you will sit here, and you will sit here, and you will sit here. Totally took charge. And as we left, she said, goodbye, lovely to see you from Harpswell. She was so amazing and so beautiful. I couldn't believe it. Right up front, there I was talking to her.
Thank you, Patty. Susan, thoughts on that?
Yeah. You know, Patty, what's great about that story is both that she was so sweet to you. I mean, what a generous attitude toward you. And also that she told everybody where they were supposed to sit. Because those are both aspects of Barbara Bush's character. She was warm and thoughtful to other people, but she was also in charge. You know, people, her grandchildren called her the enforcer. Jeb Bush, her son, told me that he thought of her as the traffic cop.
I love it. And I love what she said about herself. I'm bossy. I read that in your book, Susan.
She was not embarrassed by being sure of herself, of being taking charge of things, of being pretty blunt. And she once in a while, she did think her quick tongue got away from her. She felt that way in the 1984 campaign. You may remember she made a comment about Geraldine Ferraro that she had to apologize for. She was actually, I think she was sincerely regretful about that. But generally, Barbara Bush was who she was, and she wasn't embarrassed by that, and she wasn't going to be somebody she wasn't.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Just Add Water Floating Camps, offering houseboat vacations with panoramic views on Rangeley Lake, May through October. Reservations at thefloatingnomad.com.
President Obama first met longtime advisor Valerie Jarrett 28 years ago when she wanted to hire his fiancée, Michelle Robinson.
It may have started out where I was the mentor and the big sister, if you will, but in time, as they grow and flourish and develop, you find that it's reciprocal.
I'm Audie Cornish. Jarrett's journey from Iran to Chicago to Washington this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening here on Maine Public Radio. And coming up after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock, it's World Affairs, Surveillance Capitalism, How Silicon Valley Profits from Tracking Us. In the modern age of Facebook, Google, and smart devices, most of us are under 24-hour surveillance. These data points are collected by large tech companies and are in turn sold to and used by governments and businesses alike to influence our behavior. Dr. Shoshana Zuboff discusses her new book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, which explores what can be done to protect democracy and free thought against these new threats. Again, that's coming up at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, USA Today, Washington Bureau Chief Susan Page. She is the author of the just-released biography, The Matriarch, Barbara Bush and the Making of an American Dynasty. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Susan Page, you mentioned that Barbara Bush didn't much like the name, the word matriarch or the idea of a dynasty. Why not?
You know, when I interviewed George W. Bush for this book, he said that that she didn't believe in big shot itis. And in fact, she didn't think she was a big shot, and she didn't like people who thought they were big shots. And I think she thought both the word matriarch and the word dynasty conveyed a sense of I'm a big shot. But, you know, I think that it is hard to deny that she was the matriarch of that family. She was. She was the one who, as Patty told us, would come in and tell everyone where to sit at dinner. She's the one who really raised her kids while her husband was spending a lot of his time traveling and building first his business and then his political career. She was the one who ruled the roost when her grandchildren would spend summers with her at Walker's Point in Maine, where you are at this moment. So she was a matriarch. And so then the question is, are the Bushes a dynasty? And the Bushes are clearly a political dynasty, but I didn't mean dynasty just to refer to elective office. Because one thing that struck me in looking at the family members who followed Barbara Bush, both her children and her grandchildren, is the tradition of public service that both she and George Bush instilled in them. And you just look at her grandchildren and some of the things they've done. Her namesake, Barbara Bush, her granddaughter, co-started the Global Health Corps. Another granddaughter, Lauren Bush Lauren, helped launch a program to feed hungry people around the world. One of her grandsons, Pierce, left a career in business to take over Big Brothers Big Sisters of Greater Texas. She had another grandson who, to no one's knowledge at the time, enlisted in the Marines and served in Afghanistan. And of course, another grandson, George P. Bush, who's been elected and reelected to statewide office in Texas. And in interviewing many, although not all, of her grandchildren, they talk about the lessons that they learned from their grandmother. George P. Bush, for instance, told me that there was one summer when he went and spent some time that summer with his grandparents in the White House, and his grandmother made him volunteer at a soup kitchen one day a week while he was staying at the White House. That is a pretty powerful lesson.
We'll go to Antonio, who's calling from Augusta. Hi, Antonio. Go ahead.
Hi there. I'm calling to give you guys a goofy little story about my mother, and not Barbara Bush, but her husband, George Bush Sr. My mother used to put up enclosures for plovers on the beach in southern Maine, and I can't remember at what beach exactly this took place at.
The piping plover, the bird, right. Go ahead.
The piping plover, correct, yes, yeah. George Bush was walking his dog on a beach where dog walking, our dogs were not allowed. So my mother approached him frantically, trying to tell him that he shouldn't be there with the dog. And I'm assuming this was about 15 years ago. He was, you know, with two other gentlemen there to ensure his safety. I don't believe that they were threatened at all by my mother, but she was there with another person as well that was trying to tell her who she was approaching. And she was too passionate about, you know, getting the dog off the beach that she had no idea who she was running after. So I was probably about 15 years old at the time. I remember my mother coming home and telling me about this, and of course, not knowing who it was at the time, but I can't imagine that there was any altercation except for that I'm President Bush, and I'm going to do what I want with my dog. I'm going to walk my dog up.
Thanks, Antonio.
You know, I think...
Absolutely.
Antonio, I think your mother must have had some characteristics in common with Barbara Bush.
Thanks for your
call. The willingness to confront. You know, there was a great story that David Rubenstein, the philanthropist, told me. He had gone to on a safari in Africa with Barbara Bush, two of her granddaughters, and some other people. And they were at a pond, I guess, where there were hippos. Were the hippos or rhinos? Rhinos, I think. One of the rhinos emerged and looked like it was going to charge Barbara Bush. And the Secret Service began to stir and say, you know, what are we going to do? What should we do to protect Barbara Bush? Barbara Bush did not flinch. She seemed quite sure that the rhino would retreat. And indeed, the rhino did. And she stood her ground.
We'll go to Chris, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. How are you? Just a quick story about a friend of mine who used to deliver pizza to the Kennebunkport, to the Bush residence, and they'd come in and Secret Service would do their thing with a dog sniffer and check underneath the car. And his biggest wish was he hoped that the whoever came down to collect the pizza would be Barbara and not George W, because he was a terrible tipper. Barbara was very generous.
So Barbara was a better tipper than George. Are you surprised,
yeah.
Susan?
According to him, he was like, it's old man Bush. I wish it was Barbara, you know?
Chris, that is such a great story. And how remarkable, isn't it? We think about some of our leaders as being so remote. And here, not only were they ordering pizza, but they were the ones paying for it.
Chris, thanks for calling. We'll go to Roger calling from Falmouth. Hi, Roger. Go ahead.
Hi, Jen. Wonderful show as always. And I'll get to my question in 20 seconds. But my mother and George H.W. Bush's mother used to play on the beach in Kennebunkport when they were early teenagers. That's something I grew up with. Mm. But my question is, as a Bowdoin alum and grad, just like our 14th president, Franklin Pierce, I've always heard that Barbara Pierce Bush was a descendant of Franklin Pierce. So, Susan, can you confirm or deny that? Did you ever come across it? And if so,
yes,
did she ever talk about it?
So, yes, they were relations. They were cousins. And she was aware that they were relations. But, you know, Franklin Pierce, and excuse me that he's a fellow alum of Bowdoin with you, Franklin Pierce was considered a pretty terrible president who really was, and who was president at a time when the Civil War was approaching, and that he did not behave in the way we would hope presidents would behave in trying to avert that terrible war. So she was not, I think, delighted to remind people that Franklin Pierce was a relative, but indeed he was. And actually, I think I visited Franklin Pierce's gravesite, which is in New Hampshire, which is a very low-key place. I don't know if any of your listeners have ever gone there. It's not a great featured mausoleum the way some presidential burial sites are. It's a very modest place. But yes, he was a relative, and she was aware of that.
Roger, thank you for your call. An email from Emily. I would love to know what your guest thinks of Barbara Bush's vocal support of Paul LePage in his bid for re-election. I receive robocalls from Barbara Bush supporting Paul LePage. Given that Donald Trump's behavior, which is very much like LePage's, is what drove her from the Republican Party, I have to say I was shocked and extremely disappointed to see her openly supporting such a bully for governor. Did you ever talk to Barbara Bush about Maine's former governor, Paul LePage?
Emily, that is so interesting, and I had never talked to her about it. In fact, I didn't realize she was a supporter of his, and doing robocalls, you know, being in Maine and having Barbara Bush do robocalls for you, that has to be a good thing politically. But as with you, I'm surprised that was a candidate she chose to back, and I wonder if there's a backstory. I just don't know.
All right, we'll go to another Emily. This Emily calling from Bangor. Hi, Emily. Go ahead.
Hi. My father was a minister in Kennebunkport and had two congregational churches. And there was one year when there was a big hurricane, and a very well-loved builder in Kennebunkport repaired the Bush's house. And they began to come to my father's smaller church in the wintertime. And they just really embraced the congregation. They were on a first name basis. They apologized about the Secret Service presence. And Barbara Bush contributed recipes to the church cookbook. And then when George Bush was elected president, they brought the flag that had flown over the White House that day and gave it to the church.
Thank you, Emily.
Emily, those are great stories. I have to tell you, I bet they weren't her recipes because Barbara Bush was a terrible, terrible cook. I say that as a terrible cook myself, but if somebody made cookies and brought them, that probably wasn't. If she gave you recipes, I bet they weren't recipes of her own. They used, when they were living in Houston after leaving the White House, they got takeout. They got stuff ordered. They had someone who came in and cooked occasionally for them because cooking, Barbara Bush had many strengths, cooking not one of them. But it's interesting also that you talk about the Bushes attending the Congregational Church where your father was a minister. One of the untold stories I think about Barbara Bush is the depth of her faith. She was a very faithful person. When I was interviewing her and it was clear that she was going to pass away at some point soon, she had no fear of death. She did not see death as the end of things. She saw death as an opportunity, perhaps, to see Robin again in heaven. And at the very end of her life, she expressed to me no concern about dying, but she did express concern about dying before George Bush died, after their 73 years of marriage, of leaving him. And they had a final really poignant moment in the den of their house in the final days of her life. This den was a small den just off the living room at their house in Houston. And he said to her, "Bar, I'm not going to worry about you." And she said to him, "George, I'm not going to worry about you." So she, in effect, saying, "You should live," and he giving her permission to die. And you know what they did then? They had a drink. She had a bourbon. He had a vodka martini. They had a final drink together in those final days of her life.
Emily, thank you for your call. And Susan, I want to end with this question. We just have a little bit of time left, which is that Barbara Bush fell and hurt herself and had to postpone your final interview, and then that interview never happened. What more did you want to ask her?
You know, that's a great question, but by that point, we had spent so much time together that I think the conversation would have taken the course it did. You know, I mean, that is to say, I think something would have struck us and we would have talked about that. And I wonder if the fact that she gave me access to her diaries at the end of that fifth interview was because she thought there was a question about whether we would be able to meet again.
Well, Susan, congratulations so much on this remarkable biography, and thank you for joining us today.
Jennifer, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Susan Page is the Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, the author of The Matriarch, Barbara Bush and the Making of an American Dynasty. Sandra Harris ran the board today. We had additional help from John Keimel, Lucy Suchek, Erwin Gratz, and Willis Arnold. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.